And now on RTE Radio 1, a look at the art of essay writing on The Book Show.
Welcome to The Book Show with me, Sinead Gleeson. Tonight on the programme, we're going to talk about the essay with writers Deborah Levy and Mark O'Connell.
I didn't go around looking for other great essay writers. I was chasing some arguments.
I chat to Alison Bechdel about her graphic novel that's been made into a musical and the invention of the Bechdel test.
It's so funny to me that this has become a meme or whatever it has become.
Get in touch by email bookshow@rte.ie and find us on Twitter and Facebook at bookshowrte. Deborah Levy has recently published Things I Don't Want to Know, a long essay which is a response to George Orwell's Why I Write. Orwell's 1946 work details his personal journey to becoming a writer. Zoe Cummins took a closer look at Orwell's essay.
The man who brought us Animal Farm, 1984, and introduced us to Big Brother was George Orwell. Just 4 years before his death, he also wrote Why I Write. It appears in countless anthologies and is one of the most influential essays for writers. John Branigan of UCD.
The essay is a mixture of autobiography, I suppose, and also thinking about the craft and the role of writing.
I do not think one can assess a writer's motives without knowing something of his early development. His subject matter will be determined by the age he lives in. But before he begins to write, he will have acquired an emotional attitude from which he will never completely escape.
His own writing, the essay, is perhaps characteristically self-deprecating about his own writing. But also, his opinion of writers generally doesn't seem to be particularly high.
All writers are vain, selfish, and lazy. And at the very bottom of their motives, there lies a mystery.
Colin Graham of NUI Maynooth outlines the four main reasons that Orwell gives for writing.
The first reason is a very long paragraph, which says that most people write out of what he calls sheer egoism. That is, that most people want to be writers because they want to prove their parents wrong or they want to prove people in authority wrong. The second paragraph says that people write out of an aesthetic impulse. The third paragraph is even shorter and says that people write for historical impact, that is, to record the moment that they live in. And the fourth paragraph, which is even shorter, says that people write for political reasons. And he goes on to say, in a normal time, if I was living in a normal time, I would write for the first three reasons. But I don't live in a normal time, therefore the political has become the most important for me.
This essay talks, I think, most openly and honestly about Orwell's political motivations. It makes clear why you would write as with a political motive in mind. And it does succeed, I think, in making the case for political writing as an art, and that's what Orwell wanted to do.
It is also true that one can write nothing readable unless one constantly struggles to efface one's own personality. Good prose is like a window pane.
That metaphor of the window pane, in fact, when you think about it, looking through a window pane is not to see something clearly, it's to see things framed in a window. And that's the compromise that he comes to. This doubled idea of wanting to see the truth completely clearly, but recognizing that it's always filtered through one individual, someone who has a way of looking at the world. That shape of the window is the shape of the writer and the writer's intelligence.
That was Zoe Cummins there giving us an insight into Why I Write by George Orwell with readings by Sam Monaghan. Joining me now in studio are writer Mark O'Connell and playwright, novelist and poet Deborah Levy. Deborah, your response to Orwell's piece is Things I Don't Want to Know, and the book itself is published by independent publisher Notting Hill Editions. And they say in their own words that they're committed to reinvigorating the essay as a literary form. Do you remember where and when you first encountered Orwell's essay?
Yes, I encountered it recently. It wasn't something that I read in my 20s or 30s. Last year, my family moved from a house to a small flat. My daughter was going to university, and for the first time in my writing life, I didn't have a room of my own at the busiest time of my life to write in. So my friend, the wife and widow of the poet Adrian Mitchell, said to me, well, I think you better have Adrian's writing shed in the garden. And it was not a posh shed. It's where you store the lawnmower, but it had lamps and a desk and some bookshelves. And no internet. I could not get internet from the main house to the shed. And so I wrote this essay, having read in the shed, in the coldest winter, it snowed three times. I had to dig myself out of the shed one morning. That's where I first read Why I Write. And that's when I knew that I was going to hitch a ride on Orwell's four headings that we've just heard. I thought they were brilliant headings, and give them an airing from a female writer's point of view.
Was it your way of explaining why you write?
I wanted to write something about writing, and I didn't know what kind of form to explore a whole load of complex thoughts. I didn't want it to be a how-to-do book. I wouldn't dream of writing such a book. When I saw that heading, Political Purpose, I could see that I could give contemporary feminism a bit of a spin. I could write about what it's like to be a female writer and some thoughts about writing female characters, some of the complexities of that. Historical impulse was very hard because I thought, well, if I'm going to steal another writer's heading, I've got to be truthful. And so for historical impulse, I went back to my childhood in South Africa. I was born there, and we left when I was nine. My father was a political prisoner. He was a member of the African National Congress. And so he sort of disappeared when I was five and returned when I was nine, and we left for the UK. And just witnessing incredible injustice, savage violation of human rights, that was my historical impulse. And I knew that I would honour Orwell's journalism and his headings and try and go there. Then we had aesthetic enthusiasm, and that was a breeze in comparison. And finally, sheer egoism, which I enjoyed a lot.
And actually, Deborah, you're going to read an excerpt on that from your book of essays, Things I Don't Want to Know.
I hastily ordered eggs, beans, bacon, Bubble and Squeak, and then, realising I didn't have enough money for beans and Bubble and Squeak, decided to cancel the beans. Holding a mug of scalding tea in my hand, I made my way past the builders and bus drivers towards a formica table to begin my impersonation of the writer's life. As soon as I sat down, I reached for the white paper napkins that were kept in a glass alongside the pepper, ketchup and brown sauce, and started to write with a leaking blue biro. This is the word I wrote on my napkin: England. My mother had told me we were in exile and would one day return to the country of my birth. The idea that I was living in exile and not in England terrified me. When I told my new friend Judy, who was born in Lewisham, that I didn't really want to live in exile, she said, yeah, I'd be scared shitless too.
Deborah Levy there reading from Things I Don't Want to Know. Deborah, in that reading, you talk about being in exile from South Africa and obviously growing up there and seeing what you saw, you have a deep political grounding. Do you agree with George Orwell when he says that all writing that's not political fails in some way?
I don't think I do. That's a wish, I think, from a highly politicised man. I do agree with him when he says that writers who say, oh, I'm apolitical, I don't write about politics. I do agree that's a political decision. But there's great writing, that isn't necessarily political in the sense that Orwell might perhaps have perceived it. Baudelaire and André Breton and all the kind of playful all kinds of playful writing, Gertrude Stein, etc. So I don't think we need to obey Orwell all the way.
I'm thinking of you beavering away in the shed, and it makes me think of Virginia Woolf and of course, her famous essay, A Room of One's Own. But you mentioned great essay writers like Julia Kristeva and Marguerite Duras, including Duras' work on feminism and motherhood. Was it important for you to reference other great writers when you were writing your own essay?
I didn't go around looking for other great essay writers. I was chasing some arguments, and anything that supported those arguments would find their way in one way or another into my autobiographical essay. Virginia Woolf's A Room of One's Own. I always try and find something else to quote, something better, because it feels like a cliche, you know, something more contemporary. And I have to say that I can't find anything that much better. It just gets there. And I note that in perhaps in the 21st century, what's more useful to a female writer than a room of her own, given that we're travelling a lot, is an extension lead and some adapters.
Well, we'll get to one writer's attachment to his iPhone and technology shortly. But first, I'll just introduce writer Mark O'Connell, who writes for a number of publications, including The Millions and The Dublin Review. Mark, do you think our experiences, and I think a lot of us can relate to this, that school or college has made us fear the essay in some way?
Well, I think probably the school essay and the college essay have given the essay a bad name in that they've kind of portrayed it in a certain way. And you know, I speak as someone who has taught at university and has taught people how to write these essays and corrected these essays. But I think there's academic writing, it's one of the more restricted forms of writing. And curiously, when you sit down to write about literature as an academic, you do it in a very unliterary way. You do it in a very uncreative way. I remember when I started doing a PhD about 5 or 6 years ago, I went along to something called a thesis writing workshop. And I remember none of the advice that they actually gave us. But there was one piece of advice that I do remember. He was talking about structure and how you structure an argument. And he said, first of all, tell him what you're going to tell him, and then tell him what you told him, which is the kind of the classic way that academic writing is structured, which is an extremely frustrating way, not just to write, but also to read. And it's very limiting. So I've sort of found in my academic writing that I was always kind of straining against that. And the only way I can really approach writing is when I don't quite know what it is I'm going to say. If I know what I'm going to say, I don't really feel the urge to say it, almost. So for me, the essay should be kind of at odds with that. It should be sort of exploratory and meandering. And I'm sort of drawn to essayists who are clearly finding out what they think about a topic by having said it.
Deborah, do you think that the essay has a function, or is it just to offer, say, maybe a personal perspective on an issue?
I think it's a very freeing form to write in, because you are chasing, you have an intellectual inquiry, and on the way you're scooping up everyday anecdotes, some of your most strange thoughts that somehow relate to the thing that's being explored or analysed. So you are offering a critique of something, and there is a quite formal tone, if you like, but that tone changes. So Mark was saying, you know, that it's a hybrid form. So a lot of Zabel's work is resembles an essay. But I think that I cut my teeth on the form by reading Susan Sontag's essays, Angela Carter's great essays, The Sardian Woman. You know, she had such intellectual attack and relish and such a great sense of bawdy humour. So it's not like the essay is humourless and dry and didactic and shaking its finger at you, because we don't want to read essays like that. We want essays that open up the world, that make the world not less mysterious, but more mysterious.
Well, Deborah mentioned earlier the modern writer's attachment to their laptop. So let's hear about the inability to detach from modern technology in a timely piece by Kevin Barry. This is The Skin of Anxiety, read here by Nick McGinley.
How many times a day do I check my email? This is going to be very embarrassing. Me? I don't turn the internet off while I'm writing. and I don't have that software that blocks it. So I'll check at least once every 5 minutes during the working morning. So that's probably about 50 checks by lunchtime. In the afternoons, I gad about the Sligo Hills, often on my bike. But that doesn't stop me from fishing the iPhone out, though granted the checking will be at the more relaxed pace of about a half dozen times an hour. So we're heading towards 90 checks or so by tea time. In the evenings, I tend to check my mail quite a lot, because the US is about its working day, and you never know what might come in from over there. So we're back up to maybe 10 checks an hour by bedtime. I've checked my Gmail, I would think, at least 150 times. And this may be a conservative count. This section of the piece, for example, has so far taken me about 15 minutes to write, and I have so far checked my mail 4 times, or possibly 5.
And that was Nick McGinley reading from The Skin of Anxiety by Kevin Barry. Mark, you mentioned this essay as one you particularly liked and are drawn to, but what is it that appeals to you?
Well, it's funny for a start, but it's also, it's a very sort of pure expression of that writer, of Kevin Barry's personality. And I think the essay should be quite a pure expression of personality. I mean, Susan Sontag, when you think of her, you think of Susan Sontag, you think of her voice, her style, in a way that the novel isn't necessarily or doesn't have to be. The essay is a very personal style.
Deborah, do you think then that it's less about the topic and more about the angle that the writer takes, or the personality of themselves that comes through? What is it that makes it stand out?
The essay, a good essay, well, it depends on where the writer's attention is, because any kind of writing always depends on that. You know, if the writer's gaze on something is in an interesting place, it doesn't matter what the form is, whether it's a novel or an essay. Essays have to dramatize theory if they do it, if it's sort of working, firing. And essays are personal, and they are also if they're a film, they're also like a wide shot. You know, you pull the camera in very close to something or someone, and then you pull it back.
Mark, there's been a lot of talk about the short story being reinvigorated in some way, maybe by different publishing avenues available online. But do you think it's the same for the essay? Has the internet had some sort of rejuvenative shot in the arm effect on it?
Yeah, I think in some ways. I mean, in some ways, the essay has obviously never gone away. So to talk about a resurgence is probably not quite accurate. But I think there's more scope for that kind of writing online. There's more places where essays can be published and more ways that people can read them. But in another way, the essay is kind of, interestingly, kind of at odds with the internet.
Why so?
For me, the best essays are very difficult to kind of, to encapsulate. It's very difficult to say what A Room of One's Own is about. You can say it's about, you know, being a female writer and it's a sort of a feminist text, but it's very difficult to say what it is actually about. So the best essays to me are kind of gist resistant. They're resistant to being kind of encapsulated in the form of an idea. And the internet is very, it kind of prioritizes short bursts of writing and short ideas and easily encapsulatable ideas, things that are kind of amenable to frictionless sharing on social media and that kind of thing. And the essay, I think, is often at odds with that. So the internet does allow for a wider realm of things that can be read and published, but yeah, the essay kind of exists in an unusual tension with that, I think.
And thanks so much to Mark O'Connell and Deborah Levy. You can find links to Mark's work on markoconnell.net, and Deborah Levy's Things I Don't Want to Know is available now and published by Notting Hill Editions. Now on the book show, Alison Bechdel. She's a cartoonist best known for the comic strip Dykes to Watch Out For, which ran for a staggering 25 years. Her latest book is a graphic memoir, Are You My Mother? And I met her in New York just as her previous memoir about her father, Fun Home, was in preview for a staged musical version.
Welcome to our house on Maple Avenue. See how we polish and shine. We rearrange and re-
Alison Bechdel, Fun Home, the musical based on your graphic novel, is in preview here at the Public Theatre in New York. Did you have any fears about seeing your work transposed to the stage?
I have a lot of fears. I mean, I have seen it. I saw a version of it a year ago when they were doing a workshop, and I liked it. But so, of course, there's so many things that could go wrong or couldn't work. So, yeah, I'm pretty anxious about it.
Have you been very hands-on or hands-off? I've spoken to writers who, you know, their films get bought and they've nothing to do with it whatsoever, or people who are very involved. What about yourself?
Lisa Crown, the writer, and Janine Tesori, the composer, have talked with me a lot and listened to me, listened to my concerns, showed me what they were doing. I mean, it's not like they're just adapting some book that I did. The book is about my life, so it's very... it would be awful if it weren't handled properly.
Of course.
So far, I really trust them. I feel like they've had a deep respect for the fact that it is my actual life.
Caption. My dad and I both grew up in the same small Pennsylvania town, and he was gay, and I was gay, and he killed himself, and I became a lesbian cartoonist.
It is interesting as well when you think of words like cartooning and comic, that they themselves are very sort of comic words, and yet the things that you write about are often very serious things and very dark things.
Yeah, I like that inaccuracy though. I like the, it just makes it all a little ambiguous. Novel isn't exactly the right term, comic isn't either, but that's all the more reason to embrace them. I like to throw people off a little bit. I like to do comics that are tragic.
But when you started out getting interested in drawing and telling stories in this way, were there a lot of role models, for want of a better word? Were there a lot of gay people, lesbian women drawing cartoons, making graphic memoirs? Or was it a case of there were few and far between and you didn't have those people, so you decided you would do this so that there would be somebody in this world?
As a young lesbian, at that point in history, we were all about visibility. Like, no one could see us. I didn't see myself reflected in the culture anywhere. And so that's part of why I started drawing these comics, because I just wanted to see myself. I would even have drawn them if no one else was going to look at them, just so I could have that reflection.
Do you take any of the wrinkles away when you're drawing yourself?
Yes,
are you kinder to yourself?
A little bit. It's actually hard to draw wrinkles in gray hair. They make a drawing very confusing. My girlfriend yells at me sometimes because she says I always draw myself with this frowning expression, this serious face, but it's hard to draw yourself.
Tell me about the process and actually working on this work. This book is about your mother, and obviously she features a lot within the book. Did you spend a lot of time with her? Did you base the book entirely on memory, or did you go back and sort of hang out with her a lot more to sort of get the story down?
I talked to her a lot over the course of writing this book. I got into the habit of calling her almost every day and transcribing our conversations. I did that because, I can say this now, because my mother, she recently died. She died this spring. But the reason I started keeping track of her conversations was because she had become ill, and I was trying to keep track of all of her medical stuff, like for several years now. But then it turned into, I would write down everything she said, and I realized this is a treasure trove of information, because I'm not a fiction writer. I can't make up people's dialogue. I can transcribe it. I can pick out the interesting parts, but it's very hard for me to construct someone's voice from scratch. So I just was kind of desperate to get down her words. I think she's very funny, you know.
Is there an image in the book that particularly reminds you of your mother? When you think of your mother in this book, is there one page or image that you've drawn that you think of when you think of this book?
Oh, no, I know what it is. She's like reading a newspaper with her back to me. That's my image.
Why does that remind you of her? Why does that epitomize your mom?
Well, she was always reading something, and she was always more absorbed in whatever she was reading than she was in my actual presence.
How did she feel about the project? She obviously knew about it as you were doing it.
Yes. She was not happy about it. Ambivalent isn't even the right word. She was not pleased about it. But I also know that she felt that she couldn't tell me not to do it because she assumed I would do it anyway. I was surprised when I found that out, because I don't know if I would have the guts to do that. I think if she told me not to do it, I would probably not do it. You know, it's funny, this page actually explains it all. She told me that she felt I had betrayed her by revealing all these things in print that she thought she had told me in confidence over the years about my father, about their relationship. I didn't know that I, you know, had signed a, what do you call those forms when you...
Confidentiality agreement.
Yeah.
Did it ever make you think that maybe I'll stop, maybe I won't do this, I won't continue? Was that ever a thing you seriously considered?
No, not until I finished this book. Now I'm thinking, oh, maybe I'm done. But maybe I'm not.
There is a lot of feminism in your work, and a lot of people will know your name as being synonymous with the Bechdel test. Could you explain how it came about?
The Bechdel test?
Yeah.
It's so funny to me that this has become a meme, or whatever it has become. I wrote a comic strip in 1985, just a regular episode of my Dykes to Watch Out For strip. I remember I didn't have any ideas that week. I was bankrupt, and so I completely copied wholesale something that a friend of mine had just told me. She said she had a rule about going to see movies. She would not see a movie unless it had more than two women in it, and the two women talked to one another about something besides a man. The movie had to fulfill those three conditions, and there were like hardly any movies that she could go to see. The only one she could see at that point was Alien, because the two women talked to one another about the monster. But that was 1985, and then it disappeared. No one ever talked about it until somehow someone put something on the internet about it, got a certain kind of traction, especially among younger women, as a really simple way of, you know, showing the problem with most movies and books and advertisements. Everything is all geared to this male subject.
Give me an example of the worst offender or worst offenders, because there are a lot of them.
Well, almost anything, almost any movie you can think of. I mean, I don't know, Rocky.
Star Wars.
Yeah, they're all stories about men, and the women are just sort of vestigial creatures, just there to fulfill some function for the men. They're not true subjects. So I think it's a good test, you know? It's not my idea. I'm honored to be associated with it. I do feel like it's connected with my mission. In my work has always been to show women's subjectivity, to create complicated women characters with real lives who weren't, you know, cardboard cutouts.
And Alison Bechdel's graphic memoir, Are You My Mother?, is published by Jonathan Cape. Well, that's all we've time for this evening. Next week, we'll be coming to you at the slightly later time of 8 p.m. The book show was produced by Zoe Cummins, and we'll leave you with Regan Hutchins and a footnote.
In 1965, John Williams published Stoner, a novel charting the more or less ordinary life of its eponymous hero who moves unimpressively from his Missouri farm to a Midwestern university career. It got some praise, sold 2,000 copies, and disappeared. A recent French translation sparked a revival all across Europe and so back to the English reading world in the last year. American poet Ron Rash speaks of the effect it had on him.
I don't think you can feel the world is quite the same again. I mean, I think you feel like you've been introduced into some level that you've never been to before. It absolutely refuses to leave me. I'm haunted by it.
So let's trawl today's teeming literary seas. Is there anyone we've missed?